So when we were planning the conference, I said to Len, I said, hey, let's do a session on health policy. That'll draw a crowd. And he sort of hedged the bets and said, let's throw in lunch. So in the grand tradition of Washington, here we are. We've had lunch, and we're going to talk about health policy. I want to welcome you all here. I'm Julie Appleby. I'm with USA Today, and I cover health policy and health business and various and sundry other things that have the word health in them. When I first started covering healthcare a number of years ago, I wrote about a gentleman named Albert Serrano. And Albert had the misfortune of ending up in the hospital with a disease that they thought was going to kill him. And he was uninsured, and he was in a county hospital. And it was at a time when states and counties were struggling with their healthcare budgets. They were struggling to try to find a way for pay for things. Employers were facing double-digit insurance premiums. The nation had a rising number of uninsured, and people were worried. And Albert actually ended up on a television show, and the first night home from the hospital, he actually survived. Nobody thought this guy was going to survive, and he ended up home from the hospital on the first night, and he saw this television show, and he was actually featured in this show. And it was a show about how can we decide what to do with how can we take our limited resources and spread them around appropriately. And the message Albert got back from this was, and he cried when he told me this, he said, I felt like they had put a price on my life and had said, you know, if I had just died, they could have hired a bunch more nurses. And this was back in 1989. Sort of fast forward to now, it's almost 20 years later. We've got states and counties wrestling with how to pay for health care. We've got employers facing rising health insurance premiums. We've got a growing number of uninsured. And in the meantime, we have had one attempt by a president to do a major overhaul, and that was that didn't go very far in Congress, as you know. We've had the rise of HMOs, and we had the backlash to HMOs. We've expanded SCHIP, and we've added a drug benefit to Medicare, and we still have all these issues. We still have all these challenges. Those challenges, the uninsured, rising costs, along with many Americans who really fear and worry that they're going to lose their health insurance, have helped bring about a new debate in Washington about health reform. And it's not just in Washington. Actually, most of the action, as you probably know, have been in the states. But it's being talked about again here in Washington, and it's certainly an issue on the campaign trail that we are going to hear about and have heard about. And many of you are going to be writing about these topics as you go back and writing and producing shows. So we've brought together these four panel members today to talk about health reform efforts and how they could affect your readers. And these four experts have philosophies that pretty much cross the political spectrum, so we're going to try to give you an overview here of what's going on. These are enormous challenges that defy easy solutions. But since we're limited on time, I have asked each of the panel members to limit their first response to 3 minutes. And I've asked them in 3 minutes if they could describe what they see as the best solution for the challenges facing us right now. So we're going to start that way with 3 minutes from each of them. And then I'm going to start us off with a few questions. And this is a pretty opinionated group, so I imagine they may be tossing some questions back and forth to each other as well. So we're going to try to get a little debate going here. And in the last 20 minutes or so, we're going to open it up to questions from you. And I think there's a couple of mics somewhere here in the room. There's one back there. And we'd like you to use those mics because we are recording this session. So you'll be able to ask some questions, and the panel members will be able to respond. So let me briefly introduce everybody. David Himmelstein over here on my left. He is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he's the founder of Physicians for a National Health Reform, which is an association of physicians that promotes a single-payer, government-run health system. Karen Davis is president of the Commonwealth Fund, a foundation that supports independent health and social policy research, and it also promotes changes to the healthcare system to improve quality and cover more people. Julie Barnes is Deputy Director of the Health Policy Program at the New America Foundation, which is a nonprofit group that promotes bipartisan agreement on health reform efforts. And on the right is Tom Miller, who is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank here in Washington that promotes free market reforms as a way of expanding coverage. So starting with David, each of the panel members is now going to take 3 minutes to outline what they see as solutions to these challenges facing our healthcare system. And it's my job to cut you off if you go over the 3 minutes, which I try not to do. So, David, if you will, you could just sit there and we're going to have a little conversation. So if your mic is on, and we'll just have a
chat. Can you hear me okay? Okay. I'm a primary care doctor at the public hospital in Cambridge, and I've spent 30 years taking care of poor people who can't get care in other settings, and started my career actually in research with a study looking at patients dumped from private hospital emergency departments, the first study ever published on that led to the federal legislation banning patient dumping. And that was really my introduction to the grave problems in our healthcare system. And more recently, I've come to understand that it's not just the uninsured who have grave problems, but those with coverage. So my colleagues at Harvard Law School and I recently published a paper looking at medical bankruptcy, finding that about half of all bankruptcies in this country are caused, at least in part, by medical bills or illness. Three-quarters of the medically bankrupt had insurance, at least when they first got ill. And that informs my perspective as well, as we need a reform that helps the insured as well as the uninsured. The other major thing that informs my perspective is we have sufficient resources in the healthcare system at present to take care of every American, to provide superb care to everybody in this country for what we're now spending, if we actually spent it wisely. So we spend enormous amounts, 31 cents of every dollar, according to studies my colleagues and I published in New England Journal of Medicine, 31 cents of every dollar being wasted on health administration versus 17 cents in Canada. And the difference translates to about $350 billion each year in useless bureaucratic costs. So what I propose is what used to be called national health insurance is now referred to as single-payer national health insurance, essentially get rid of the insurance companies that provide no added value to our healthcare system and drain about $80 billion in unnecessary overhead. We know that overhead in a public system would cost about $80 billion less for just insurance overhead. And the paperwork they inflict on doctors and hospitals would save us another about $270 billion. We could eliminate virtually all hospital billing, virtually all doctor billing complexity, as they've done in Canada, and it's clear this is doable. Now, we already spend twice what Canada does per capita, and if one is willing to keep spending at that level, one could have a Canada deluxe system without the waiting lists and shortages in some forms of technology that Canada has suffered. And you could readily provide care to every American, not only to the uninsured, but to upgrade coverage for everybody in this room. Nobody in this room, I suspect, has coverage as good as the average Canadian enjoys or people in most other nations. So we have something to offer most Americans. We can't offer Jack Rowe, who was the president of Aetna, the $250,000 a day he made while he was president of that firm. But we could offer job retraining and placement benefits to the million insurance workers who are currently employed doing useless activities. We could eliminate...
David, that's unfortunately 3 minutes are up.
Okay.
And we're going to hold people to that. It's a tough crowd. But we're going to get a chance to come back and ask some questions. So, Karen, if you could please have your 3 minutes.
We agree on the problem. So I'll try to lay out a somewhat different solution. I think we're on the wrong track. We have growing numbers of uninsured. Certainly we pay more than any other country and get less for it. As Julie mentioned, the Commonwealth Fund is committed to trying to lead America to a high-performance health system, and we have a commission dedicated to doing that. And they've laid out 5 strategies for an ambitious agenda for our next president to really get at the root of some of these problems. The first is simple. It is cover everyone. So I'll come back to that if I've got minutes left. But that's got to be part of any health reform. But it's not enough to do coverage alone. So the second, we've got to deal with the cost problem. And we focus primarily upon reforming the way doctors, hospitals, other healthcare providers are paid. Third, it doesn't do any good to have an insurance card if you can't get care. if you don't have a regular source of care that's accessible to you. So the commission recommends moving toward a more organized healthcare system, whether that's a patient-centered medical home or networks of doctors and hospitals that are accountable for your total care and that are accessible to you 24/7 and help you weave your way through the healthcare system. They coordinate care. The fourth solution is really narrowing the variation in quality and efficiency and bringing everybody up to the highest level care that is possible to provide. We all know there's wide variation, but we haven't invested in the information technology, the public information, the quality improvement activities, the chronic care disease management activities that it really takes to not only narrow that variation, but to get everybody up to what is the best that's achievable. And finally, we need national leadership. That's why this election is so important. And we need the public and private sectors working together. So rather than abolishing the private insurance industry, as David has recommended, we're really looking for a way of getting collaboration between the public and private sector to move to high performance. Quickly on coverage, obviously covering everybody is the most important. The commission feels like a mixed public-private insurance system is probably the most practical way to go and would, in fact, achieve many of the goals that it's important to achieve. We believe in shared responsibility, including employers continuing to either provide insurance or to help finance coverage, and that's an important difference across the presidential candidates. We particularly believe that private insurance, while it should stay in the game, should take everyone, so eliminating some of the practices that lead them to discriminate against the sick. So it's a historic opportunity. We're delighted to see a major issue in this election and delighted to be here.
Thank you.
And Julie? I'm Julie Barnes with the New America Foundation at the health policy program at the New America Foundation, which is a nonpartisan, which is a big word in this town, nonpartisan nonprofit that is concentrating on national health care reform and making it happen. We have a mission at the health policy program, and our mission is to preach hope and dispel fears about the possibility of national health care reform. It can happen, it will happen, but most importantly, it must happen. So I start by imploring all the journalists in the room to include the solutions in your reporting of the problems. We need to not be negative, and we need to be positive about national health care reform happening. Okay, everybody with me. I'll get out the pom-poms later, but that is our mission, and here's what we think. We think we need to cover all Americans. We think we need to reduce costs. And we think we need to improve quality. These are not new ideas, but here's what's different. We want to do it comprehensively. These are not incremental reforms. Coverage, cost, and quality are inextricably linked. I will give you one example because I only have 3 minutes. If you cover everyone, we will have a financial crisis as the system currently is set up. We need to, for instance, change how we pay doctors so that we are not paying them based on the quantity of care, we're paying them based on the quality of care. Can you imagine if we paid doctors based on how much time they spent with the patient, based on coordinating their care across the many specialists they may see, if we reimburse them to follow up with a phone call to make sure they're getting the treatment they were supposed to get when they left, and they're taking the prescription drug that they were prescribed when they left, which we're not right now, we're told, can you imagine the costs that would be reduced as a result of the second visit not happening or the inpatient visit not occurring? Because we were paying based on quality, not quantity. We would even, I would opine, have happy doctors because they would be getting back to the business of quality of care. So we cannot cover everyone without reducing those costs. and we can reduce the cost by improving quality. Don't let anybody tell you different. Anybody has any questions, go to our website. The research is there. The second thing I want to say, do I have time? 5 seconds. Julie Appleby wants us to solve the healthcare crisis in 3 minutes. Go.
I am from USA Today.
Yeah, that's
we're brief. Thank you, though. That was very.
One more thought.
We'll give you 5 more seconds.
5 more seconds. It cannot happen unless it's a bipartisan approach. When we review proposals, and there's so many of them out there, whether it's a state reform, a trade association proposal, or a congressional proposal, the very first thing we do is we look at whether or not it can garner bipartisan support or whether it has bipartisan support. If we do not get 60 votes in the Senate, we can ram something through with one party, and it will not be sustainable. We need to protect whatever reform we have in place from repeal and from attack later on. So we don't want a 2-year plan.
Okay,
we want a sustainable plan.
We're going to get to that.
That's my 15 seconds for thought.
Thank you. That was good. That was good. And now, Tom, you get the last 3-minute session here.
Thank you, Julie. While I'm picking up escape velocity, I'll revise and extend my remarks. Solutions begin with framing the most important problems, key opportunities. Most of all, we need to strengthen incentives and capabilities for producing more efficient, higher value health care and better health outcomes. We need to rebalance our health investment portfolio. Public policy and private choice should focus less on expanding the quantity of insurance coverage and fighting over the political distribution of health care dollars, and more on realigning incentives, improving accountability, facilitating meaningful competition, and producing more actionable information about health care choices over more extended time horizons. No matter how much we collectively commit to pay for health care services through various private and public intermediaries, we won't begin to achieve a sustainable value-based health care system until we improve the upstream and downstream factors to determine most health care spending and long-term health outcomes. What's upstream? The population has to become and remain healthier before it reaches the doctor's office or the hospital and takes steps to enhance its health when not directly engaged with the health delivery system. Downstream, healthcare providers need to be measured on the efficiency and effectiveness of their performance and rewarded accordingly. It's the comparative efficiency of the care that's actually delivered by accountable providers and healthcare teams in practice that matters much more than the theoretically best comparative effectiveness of any given treatment, protocol, or reimbursed healthcare service or product. What does this mean in terms of public policy reforms? More public and private investments in primary prevention, early education, navigational assistance, and decision support. Less on the illusion of standardized comprehensive health insurance coverage that doesn't, at the end of the day, deliver as much value as it pretends to do. Change our policy biases away from regulation and mandates and toward more valuable information, accountable choices, and level playing field competition. Second, facilitate enhanced healthcare aggregation information of what we currently have available to use rather than what we imagine as a public good available for competing intermediaries to develop and disseminate consumer preference-weighted measures of comparative provider performance. Third, reduce our current distortions to the healthcare marketplace caused by public policy without adding new ones to the list. On the margins, less third-party payment and more first-party choice and control, targeted subsidies for those most in need, but giving up on the illusion that everyone else will pay for someone's healthcare costs. More equity and tax subsidies for all purchasers of healthcare, distinguishing coverage pooling options between simple risk averaging and risk reduction. It's the latter one that changes cost growth. Finally, let's inject some humility and skepticism into our discussion of how much changes in public policy can transform the evolution of our healthcare system. We can do more harm, and we've done it before, but doing more good will require the more decentralized, incentive-compatible, patient-centered actions of everyone focused on producing better health outcomes and lower costs. Thank you.
That was 3 minutes. Thank you.
Wow.
Very nice. Okay, let me start out, and this is a question for all of you, and I want you to, be brief, because this is sort of a theme here today, but briefly, each of you, we'll start with David, and then maybe we'll move it around a little bit. What is the single biggest impediment to healthcare reform?
Single biggest impediment is the firms that are making hundreds of billions of dollars in revenues out of the current healthcare system. So Jack Rowe doesn't want to give up his $225,000 a day. The drug industry, which makes three times the average profit of the Fortune 500, is loath to give up the billions in excess profits that it makes from
our so-called competitive health system. Okay, so it's corporations. Corporations are in the way.
And you even have Jim Roosevelt, who's likely to decide who's the nominee of the Democrats. He's the chair of the Credentials Committee of the Democratic Party, and his daytime job is the CEO of an HMO.
Okay, so that's David's thoughts. Tom, what do you think? What is the single biggest impediment to health care reform?
Thinking that it's someone else's job to improve the health care we receive rather than our steps as the agents we enlist to do it for us.
So we need to have more individual responsibilities, which you're saying.
That's individual responsibility. Health care is overregulated, overpoliticized, and oversubsidized. Unlike many other sectors, the reason it hasn't been transformed the way many other collision areas of our economy have been is because we always think it's kind of some third party's answer.
So it's somebody else's problem to solve. Karen, what do you think? What is the single biggest impediment to health care reform?
I'm an economist. I think the biggest impediment is how we're going to pay for it. So what it costs and who pays. I think there's a fair amount of understanding in terms of federal budget costs. It's going to cost about $100 billion a year. So where do you find that money? Some work we've supported called Bending the Curve shows you can get half or a bit more than that if you're willing to use the power of government to really transform the healthcare system. That means comparative effectiveness with real teeth. If something doesn't work, insurance plans won't cover it, and they won't pay more for something that costs more than something
that's equally effective. So it's cost. It's getting a handle on the cost.
So comparative effectiveness, investment in information technology. I agree with Tom on public information and transparency of information. You're still going to have to come up with a third to half of the dollars. And so that's going to mean getting serious about new revenues, and I don't think that the candidates have really
focused on that. So that's the big impediment. What do you think?
I think we can't have a fast enough conversation.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, everyone needs to have a conversation, and I mean everyone. The insurers, the employers, the unions, the consumers, the doctors, the hospitals, and the policymakers need to have about a year-long conversation so we can get our acts together, so we can coordinate and collaborate and have one message to present to the next president of the United States what it is we need to do.
And Julie, let me follow up with this one. Presidents from Truman to Nixon to Clinton all had proposals for universal health coverage. With the exception of Medicare and Medicaid, most major health reform efforts have failed. What makes you think it can happen this time?
What's different this time? Great question. It is so different this time.
That wasn't the plan.
The difference this time is we're not writing a legislation proposal in a room with a closed door. There are numerous proposals out there, and people are coming together. Strange bedfellows. You notice the unions and the employers are coming together and things called like Better Healthcare Tomorrow. There are all sorts of coalitions that are happening out there in the marketplace that represent different stakeholders that I just mentioned and trying to figure out what they agree on, what the sticking points are, and what our coordinated message will be to the public and to the policymakers to make it actually happen this time. That was not happening in 1993-94. That conversation was not happening. The conversation, that's exactly what the New America Foundation is attempting to do, is be part of that coordination effort. Bring together the research to back up the message for why it's important, and then sell it to the stakeholders. Here's what we've got for you. Here's what we've got for you. Here's what we've got for you. It's a public-private collaboration. But if we don't have that conversation and get our acts together fast, convince the Hill this is what you need to be saying, and then present
and see what happens.
The book.
Tom, do you think it's different now? What is different now? Or do you think healthcare reform is going to happen in the next
few years? What's different now is we have two more years to exhaust old solutions and go through the dependent behavior in the past and we'll move on to good solutions.
So you don't think it's going to happen for a couple more years?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. But I think that we're asking better questions as opposed to the questions we asked in the past. We're forgetting about that in the middle of this health policy debate where we're going back to older solutions as opposed to moving ahead to find what on the ground will work better.
Karen, there's been a lot of talk on the campaign trail, and you know, this also comes out of the whole Massachusetts thing, and we've got some differences between the Clinton and the Obama plans on the individual mandate, and that means, you know, do we require everybody to have insurance if we're going to require insurers to sell it to everybody? Do you think we can reach this goal of universal coverage that you have without requiring individuals to purchase or to have insurance in some fashion?
Well, I think we'll probably never get to 100% coverage, but I think it's important to try for that and to at least have near universal coverage. And that's first and foremost putting the dollars on the table that make the premiums affordable. It's secondly having administrative mechanisms that make it very easy to get signed up. My favorite is to do it through the tax system. So you file in April in a couple of weeks and you certify whether you've got insurance or not. And if not, you're going to have to pay a certain percent of your income toward that coverage and be given choices, like in the federal employees' health benefits.
Some people aren't going to like that. They're going to say, wow, they're making me buy something I don't want to buy.
Well, I think it's we're never going to get to a high-performance health system until everybody's covered. The single biggest determinant of whether people get care is whether they have insurance. So half of the population doesn't get preventive care, not up to date with preventive care. We've got a half to two-thirds of the population that don't have the chronic conditions controlled. And when you look at study after study, why those failures to achieve the kind of health outcomes that other countries achieve, it's because we leave out significant parts of the population.
So mandates are one thing. Now, Tom, on the Republican side, there's a lot of talk about the tax system and tax credits. But critics of tax credits say they really are only going to help, I don't know, a few 6-7 million people of the 47 million actually go out and purchase coverage. What is the reason the tax credits are sort of the main proposal being offered by the Republicans if it's going to cover so few people?
Different vending machine. Republicans like to do it through the tax slot. Democrats will do it through the spending side. At the end of the day, we can retarget that assistance to pick up people who are kind of losing out of that competition.
What do you mean by that? How do you retarget a tax credit? What do you mean by that?
Well, first off, I mean, there's different versions of that. I think if you do kind of a flat type tax credit, then it ends up being fairer to those who are lower income than the way the current tax is.
You mean like a refundable one? So even if I don't pay taxes, I would get some kind of a tax credit?
Everybody gets a threshold of necessary assistance, but people are not given more if they have more resources. That's the way it works on the tax exclusion. But at the end of the day, no matter what we do with tax subsidies, and part of those tax subsidies just result in a higher cost of care, higher cost of insurance, and that's really net value. Some of that's drained off. We're chasing after a moving target we can't catch up with. No matter how much we tax ourselves to pay for this care, as long as it continues to grow at a rate faster than the economy and those revenues to support it, you're chasing after it the wrong way.
So we'll never cover all uninsured unless we get a handle on the cost.
Well, if you want to get a handle on the cost, you want to get a handle on the value. It's fine to pay more for health care if it's worth it. It's the mismatch between what we spend and what we receive that's a fundamental problem. People want to spend half their income on really great health care, and it's necessary. That's fine, but they need to see it more transparently and not overspend for it, because we cannot subsidize everyone to pay for something that's growing faster than the economy's growing and think we're going to catch up with it.
David, you've talked a lot about you don't think mandates or tax credits will work. Why is that?
Well, we've actually had the concrete example in Massachusetts where we have a health reform that's very much like what Mrs. Clinton proposed in the optimum circumstances, a low on insurance rate, a wealthy state with a solid economy when the thing was implemented, and it's already falling apart. In fact, we've covered probably less than half of the uninsured. Costs are far higher than were forecast, and there's already talk of repealing the thing because it's unaffordable. And basically, you can't afford it because we've left $6 billion in administrative costs on the table that a reasonable reform of the healthcare system would get. We're still paying 12 cents of every healthcare dollar to our health insurance companies. We're still paying hospitals and doctors for enormous amounts of bureaucracy, and we have no mechanism for health planning, so we have a proliferation of technology so that people are getting CT scans who have no need for them and getting the equivalent of 500 chest x-rays each time, causing a 1 in 2,000 chance of a fatal cancer, because that's profitable for the radiologists and for the institutions that are building those. And we have no mechanisms for confronting those. The things Tom suggests as ways to approach these are frankly just meaningless. Half of the country has insufficient population density to have conceivable competition in healthcare. A town's only hospital will not compete with itself. The only neurosurgeon in a region will not compete with herself. Karen's group has shown in the existing tax credit program, which we have for displaced workers, 80% or more of the total dollars in that tax program, tax credit program, have gone for the overhead of administering that tax program. So what he's suggesting is actually adding more administrative complexity and cost. We already have the most competitive healthcare system with the highest out-of-pocket costs in the world.
So David's saying your program's not going to work.
Well, let's just get kind of a couple of facts on the table as opposed to allegations and surmises. Administrative costs. Look at the official data that the CMS reports. 14% is the private share administrative cost of private insurance. Not your inflated figures. 7%
I'm actually quoting 12%, but you're ignoring the paperwork they inflict on doctors and hospitals. And the overhead that I'm talking about is the targeted tax credit for displaced workers. And in that program, 80% or more of federal spending has gone for the administration of that program. There's clear documentation on that, Tom.
I'm making no case for that particular tax credit program. Now let's talk about another thing you put out. We have the highest out-of-pocket costs in the world. Take a look at OECD data. We are actually below the average of OECD countries in terms of out-of-pocket costs. Your numbers just are not there. They're nice theories, but not in the reality.
As a percentage, but not as an absolute, Tom. And actually,
absolute numbers. Absolute numbers don't mean anything. We have a larger economy and higher costs. It's the percentage of what you're spending.
No, as a percentage of income,
so this is why health reform is so difficult, and why we're going to have a lot of conversations about this in Washington. Is it single payer or nothing? I mean, no candidate is proposing a single payer.
Well, the problem is it's single payer or nothing that works. So, you know, when in 1988, Mike Dukakis passed a mandated health reform in our state, which was an employer mandate plus an individual mandate on the self-employed, our group said, nice sentiment, won't work. 2 years later, there were more uninsured in the state of Massachusetts than there were when that bill was passed. In 1993, they did that same thing in Oregon. In 1993, they did the same thing in Minnesota. In each case, there have been more uninsured 2 years after the reform was passed than the day the reform was passed. We've had
I
think the lesson to be learned from Massachusetts is that states can't do it alone without federal help. I think, in fact, Massachusetts has been a success. In 18 months, they've enrolled 300,000 uninsured people out of a total of somewhere between 450,000 and 600,000, depending upon which data source you look at. The only reason costs are high is because they've done a fantastic job of enrolling 300,000 people. In fact, they've held premium increases to about 5% a year, and a lot of states throughout the country would like that. So where you're getting the problem is when you hit a recession, states are not in a position to take care of the increased numbers of low-income people and the people who lose their insurance because they leave their job. So I think what we do need is national leadership. We need a federal strategy. And I think the thing, the connector in Massachusetts has worked very well. The things that are in some of the candidates' plan is to also offer a Medicare-like product. Now, that's something a state cannot do. But rather than something as impractical as saying everybody's got to give up their coverage, we're going to go into a brand new system, if you give people the choice of a good public program like Medicare that has low administrative costs, 2%, not 12%, not 14%, that has lower provider payment rates, you'll find many people will find that premium more affordable, whether it's with a tax credit of $5,000 per family that Senator McCain has advocated, or a tax credit that protects you from anything over 10% of income, as Senator Clinton has recommended. Give them premium assistance using the tax system, but give them the option of coverage under a public program. Don't require that everybody move into a public program. Just give it as an option.
So you're saying it's an option.
But it's worth just saying, in Massachusetts, as a primary care doctor on the ground, a lot of those folks who've been supposedly covered have been given cards that are virtually useless. They have co-payments and deductibles so high the patients can't possibly afford them, and they've just tripled them in the second year of the program for the near poor, so that it's now $15 every time they want to go see a primary care doctor. And I can tell you, we have patients in the hospital because they can't afford the outpatient care that's supposedly covered under that premium. I admitted someone a few weeks ago with asthma because they couldn't afford their asthma medication. We have a fake program in place.
Julie, you were talking about how we can't do this incrementally. Why not? Why not let the states like Massachusetts and other states try things and let's see what works? Why can't we?
Massachusetts is an excellent example of why they have done all of the right things and they still are stopped short of covering all. The main problem in Massachusetts, to be fair, is they miscounted the uninsured. They have fired the contractor now who has miscounted the uninsured. They're going back to Census Bureau statistics, and now they'll be set to provide enough subsidies, which is the cost problem going on in Massachusetts. And I agree with Karen. It is much more a success story than anything else. They tried to do comprehensive care. They also, unlike every other state in the union, had an uncompensated care pool of money from which to draw. And they had a very low, they have 5.7 uninsured rate right now. They have an incredibly low uninsured rate. So they were able to do some of those things. But the reason why you can't do just coverage is because they're coming up against cost issues. You have to reduce the cost first. And you have to subsidize enough so you don't run into Dr. Himmelstein's problem of having people who can't afford their asthma. So you have to, and Barack Obama has made this famous, you can't have a mandate unless it's affordable. We're not going to force Americans to buy what they cannot afford and make them go from, you know, rent decisions to healthcare decisions. No one thinks that's okay. We have to be very, very careful about how we set up our program and our subsidies so there's sliding scales that make sense. Some states have done this very successfully, although in much smaller slivers than Massachusetts. Look at Indiana. They've got charts and graphs about how they're going to subsidize this person and this person with this income and this family with this income. And they've thought through that, but they have done it for a very small window of folks because they cannot cover everybody because they are a state with very real budgetary crises. Medicare will drive payment reform. That's the federal government's job. So if we're going to reform payments system and how we pay our doctors, we're going to be looking at Medicare and doing it from the federal level. So there's only so much that we can ask states to do, although they're being incredibly innovative. And I would ask the journalists to go ahead and explore the solutions that are going on in your state. And if they're not in your state, look at the state next door, because there are some incredible things. I was just at the National Governors Association yesterday. They're doing some incredible things across the country to try to solve this problem. And they're trying to solve the problem because they can't afford not to. It's causing more problems and more weight on the system in their emergency rooms and their public health care clinics than it is to insure those folks and to offer the subsidy.
So Medicare is going broke. We have a war going on. State budgets are tight, and we're headed into an economic downturn. Where's the money for all these subsidies going to come from?
Oh, we've got the money.
Where's it going to come from?
We've got the money.
Well, that's why the single payer actually makes sense, that there is enough money in the health care system, but you've got to take it out of something that's useless at present. And, you know, the only way to do that is to say we're not going to pay for the million people doing useless jobs. And, you know, there's a fantasy that we're going to manage care better. And the disease prevention, you know, it actually studies show that when you prevent obesity and you treat tobacco addiction, you raise health care costs because those people live longer.
Now. And if single payer was palatable to the American people and the insurance industry wouldn't stop it from happening, we might agree with you.
Well, it's palatable.
But it's not. It's not going to happen.
I'll quote Julie's paper in this. USA Today poll shows that 62% of Americans favor a single payer program like Medicare, paid for out of taxes, covering all Americans for all necessary medical care. So the barrier is not... And if I can ask people to is there anyone who won't respect an embargo in this room? Survey coming out next week showing that 62% of American doctors favor single-payer national health insurance, more than the proportion who favor lesser reform.
So do they favor that if their salaries will be fixed by that government system?
Surveys show that doctors are prepared to give up 10% of their current incomes in exchange for a marked reduction in their paperwork. So, yes, the answer is yes, they would even do that. But not unless we're actually doing something that helps our patients, helps our society. And let's get back to practicing medicine and stop being business people and cogs in a giant commercial machine.
All of these ideas for saving money are very interesting. When it gets down to it, though, don't we also have to start talking about how much we can afford in terms of new technologies, et cetera. Let's say we've got a new drug that will add 4 weeks of life, but it costs $30,000. Let's just assume for a minute that everybody is covered. Do we still need to decide whether or not we use that drug?
Well, we only need to decide if we think that someone else has paid for it that didn't cost us anything. And of course, then the demand for that is going to be infinite. But we're kind of, once again, kind of in this usual pigeonhole of let's round up the money and let's kind of tell people what they're going to do, and we take enough hostages, we can kind of reorganize the system. Instead, we need to respect the fact that different people are going to have different needs, different preferences, different resources. We can help people who are at the bottom of the ladder to assist them because they can't help themselves, but we can't subsidize everyone and think we're coming out ahead on volume and making up those losses.
And if we go to a tax credit thing, wouldn't that require a lot more people to go on the individual market, and what are we going to do to help those people on the individual market actually buy coverage if they have
Well, we can regulate the individual market less rather than more, because it turns out that it actually functions better in that circumstance than what some states have done in that regard. In addition, there are other ways to pool individuals in a kind of non-group market outside of the employer workforce, which you should get more creative about if you wanted to do that. If there's demand for it, you've got a different customer base. Right now, the individual market is a residual. But it can fill in some of the cracks of what is a gradually shrinking employer-based market. But let's kind of catch up a couple of things that have been going on here. You know, we talk about kind of capping people's exposure to out-of-pocket costs or the premium. The Clinton proposal today. You know, think about that. 10% of your income should go for your premium. Right now, the standard family policy, and what was used in the New York Times piece was the individual market, which is normally disdained because it costs a lot less for a family policy. If you have an employer-based policy, it's on average about $12,000, $13,000. So what's 10% of that? If you have $130,000, you pay 10% of your premium. It just diverted wages. So the idea that we're going to have that, we're actually paying much more for our health care than 10%, maybe 10% out of pocket is one in that regard. Karen talked about kind of how health insurance is such a great determinant. It is of the health care you receive. It's not the most important determinant of your health, however. If you actually look at education, broader measures of socioeconomic status, much more powerful determinant of how your health is going to be on a long-range basis, whether you get all those chronic conditions, than all that health care you may have been covered for when you were at a younger age.
I'm going to let Karen respond to that, and then I want you all to think about it. If you want to ask a question, there's a microphone in the back, and we're going to open up to questions in a few minutes. But if you'd like to respond to the quality thing, and then one final thing, I'd like each of you to also give one idea for these folks on stories that they can go back to their respective outlets and work on related to this. Just one brief idea, but Karen, let you respond to Tom if you like, and then each of you give me an idea, and then we're going to take questions if y'all want to line up in the back there.
Well, I don't think it's feasible unless the financing is shared across federal government, state government, employers, and households. So if employers are making a contribution, and 80% of people say they want employers to continue to contribute to health benefits, then setting a maximum, not a minimum, as Tom has implied, of a 10% of income ceiling on the most that anyone would have to pay is part of it, as are federal revenues and state revenues. We can get some savings out of administrative, but we're really only going to get savings if we're willing to make system reforms. I would start with comparative effectiveness. So rather than your example of a drug that gives you 4 additional weeks of life, let's start with a drug that costs you twice as much and doesn't do any better for anyone. Why should we pay twice as much? So being willing to use the cloud of government to, first of all, determine the cost effectiveness of alternative drugs, devices, and procedures, tie it into benefit design, give it real teeth, saying we're not going to pay for things that don't work, we're not going to pay more for things that don't work any more than a current drug that's already on the system. And instead of waving our arms, really having honest estimates of the difference that would make. So we engaged Lewin Group, and on that particular option, they said $350 billion of savings are possible to the health system over 10 years if you're really willing to have comparative effectiveness. There's some savings from information technology. You don't get them for 7 years. So you have to be willing to put upfront money into the system
to see the results down the line. Great. Well, we could
really
talk for a while, but
thing, one thing, which is this claptrap about infinite demand for healthcare. I invite any of you who are looking for your next colonoscopy and knocking down my door, you know, to come and say, people want the medical care they need. They don't want the medical care they don't need. And when my patients say, I want a CT scan, I say, for what? Here are the risks, and most of the things we do in medicine have real risks and real costs for patients, that are not financial costs. There's not an infinite demand for something that has a 1 in 2,000 chance of killing you, the next CT scan.
Okay, so we've got a few people lined up. Real quickly, if anybody has an idea or two for stories to take back, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. So, no story ideas. Okay.
Oh, no, well, sure.
Okay.
I didn't know who you were starting with. Write about how we cannot not afford healthcare reform. We just published a study yesterday that said the cost, the economic losses due to the uninsured, so the cost to society due to the uninsured is $204 billion. So we're going to be talking about the economy probably for a while. If you want to write a story that talks about the economic recession, you write about healthcare and how we have to reform it if we're going to have any hope of fixing those problems.
Tom, any thoughts?
I have a simple story idea which is never written about in health policy circles. Why is it that by somehow shifting costs, we're going to make them go away just because someone else is paying them, whether it's through the tax system, whether it's an employer or an individual? That hasn't changed what those costs are. We just rearranged the financing of them. In the same way, why is it that we aren't willing to pay for it individually? It costs too much, not worth the value. We somehow think that if it's done collectively, it becomes a better value.
David?
A couple of things. One is that there are 15,000 doctors and physicians for a national health program, and there's at least one in virtually all of your communities who could talk about why it is that doctors are supporting this. A second is related, and that is the costs in your communities. Government is currently paying 60% of total health care costs if you include things like public school teachers and firemen and policemen as a government cost, and a story about what it's actually costing in your community and why it is that transferring to a fully public system is a far lower cost than would otherwise seem.
And Karen?
Follow the money. More stories on the prices that are charged for devices, pharmaceuticals, a whole array of healthcare services, and the different prices that are charged to different kinds of patients. I think we've really got to find out why we are unwilling to use purchasing power of government programs and private insurance to get a better deal for what we're buying. But I also believe in success stories. So I think looking at better ways of organizing care systems, things like patient-centered medical homes, like organized care systems, like hospitals that are working to reduce avoidable hospitalizations, I think a lot of the answer to the cost problem is keeping people out of hospitals. So whether it's the asthma, making sure people take their medications, the what are called ambulatory sensitive hospitalizations, or the things that people go home from the hospital and don't know how to take care of themselves and aren't supported and wind up back in the hospital again. Our studies, our state scorecards show the single biggest predictor of variation in Medicare spending is the proportion of Medicare patients that are back in the hospital within 30 days. So find the success stories, point to the examples of excellence, the things that are out there that we can all build on, successful ways of achieving better quality at lower cost.
Great ideas. All those are great ideas. Okay, let's start in the back with a question.
Hi, Andrew Boltz, an independent journalist. Just wondering about, we've heard several people talk about making that any health care reform comprehensive. And I'm wondering how comprehensive do you think it can be or should be? Because there are a lot of things where there are a lot of people proposing more comparative effectiveness studies. And yet, in the typical presentations, that's usually comparing one medical intervention to another medical intervention. The basic premise being that medical intervention of some sort is the best intervention that we should take in the best public policy. When you take a broader look, both within the United States and comparing the U.S. to other countries, there is little correlation. In fact, there seems to be a reverse correlation between how much medicine you do and how healthy people are. The U.S. continually falls behind other countries that spend a half or less per person and do much less medical intervention. So should we, in looking at this, take the broader trend? It seems like Tom Miller's been the one most often referring to education, other social policies that affect health and perhaps will affect the ultimate demand for medical care. Should food policy, should farm subsidies, which make junk food cheaper than fresh fruit be part of health care reform? How comprehensive does it need to be?
Who wants to take that one on?
Well, we're building most of our costs into the system well before they arrive at the doctor's office. And it's an all points bulletin. This is community level, you know, individual level, families, educational systems. All this stuff matters if what you care about is improved health for the population. But in fact, our politics doesn't care about that. What we care about is who gets the money and whose favorite scheme gets endorsed. That's what comprehensive reform threatens to take us down to step two again, as a focusing on, is are people getting healthier? Are they getting something out of the system that actually works for them? And is there a way to kind of do that so it delivers better value? There are other tools beyond insurance, beyond public payments, beyond subsidies, that would be much more effective in carrying that out. And we need to be much more creative about it because we keep investing in the same dry holes and thinking we're going to get different results.
Anybody else?
We've been very clear from the start that reform of the healthcare system needs to be part of a much broader reform in our society. We've said the public health budget needs to be doubled from 3% to 6%. That's a more important determinant of health than medical care. And not only that, but the standard of living of the poor, particularly in the society, are a far more important determinant than that. And that's actually one of the major problems we face in this country, is that policies like those that Tom advocates have redistributed funds away from those in need and towards the wealthy in the society. And the reform that he advocates in healthcare would accelerate that by being, in fact, regressively financed, so that a progressively financed healthcare system is very much part of improving the standard of living. And yes, we'd be prepared to divert funds out of medical care into an improved standard of living for the poor and lower middle class in our society, and for raising tax rates back on the upper classes in our society.
Karen?
I think the main reason other countries get better results or higher value for what they spend is they put more money into primary care and less into specialty care. We have the same number of physicians per capita as other countries. A third of our doctors are primary care doctors. In other countries, it's at least half. We've gone for 10 years down the route of consumer-directed healthcare, which has really meant high deductibles, which means we've made it harder for people to afford just to get in to get basic primary care from their physician. We can learn from other countries that make it very easy to get care from a regular doctor who you've been with for a long period of time. There's no financial barrier to that care. Everybody's lined up with a medical home that really takes responsibility for making sure that they're getting all of the basic things taken care of. So those are the big things that differ. I was shocked in New Zealand to learn that they don't even pay for x-rays in the ambulatory sector. If you're a hospitalized patient, they'll pay for it. But they don't put a lot of money into highly specialized care or paying a lot for highly specialized care.
Want to tackle that one?
Well, just because one of the reforms that I keep talking about that's going to, you know, improve quality but reduce costs simultaneously is, I don't like the comparative effectiveness because I think it stops short of what we actually need. Comparative effectiveness is measuring one treatment versus another treatment and seeing what is successful across a broad, you know, population, and then we decide what the standards are. Decide what the standards are, but let's concentrate on what the best practices are. So we're learning from sharing the information what's working for various folks. It might be have regional differences, but whatever it is, that's a standard that we need to put in place so we can help coordinate care that will help reduce costs, because the answer might be we don't treat that. And the answer might be we might treat that cheaper. And I also disagree with spending our money on expanding the public system. I think the private market is coming forward and answering some of these questions about access. The Minute Clinics attached to Walmarts and CVSs, people are getting their strep throat swabs taken care of at kind of these places. What we need, though, is to make sure that they're doing it right, that it's staffed properly, that they're attached to a greater healthcare system, that we're sharing that information back with a primary care doc. Hello? I mean, these are things that strike me as totally obvious, but I'm not running the healthcare system yet. But we will get there, and we will reduce costs and have more money to play with, and farm subsidies is next. But I think for now, we've got our work cut out for us.
We'll hold farm subsidies for the next luncheon. But next question, please.
Henry Malosky, independent journalist. I don't want to talk about health care. I want to talk about national politics. I'd like your opinions on where this presidential race is going in terms of any possibility of health reform in the next administration. One of the things that helped to kill the Massachusetts early attempt at reform was Michael Dukakis's plan was passed and ran right into the teeth of a severe recession. And so whatever coalition was created to support reform, trade, under the pressure of that. Anyone who's watched the stock market in the last few months or looked at the economics of this country, I guess there's still some debate on business pages about whether we're yet entered into a recession, but other people have a feeling that we already are in one. It's been said that the next president will inherit a huge number of economic problems. And given the history of health reform debate in this country, that will eclipse meaningful reform. If you look at past history, what is your forecast on that issue?
I think past history shows us that major social initiatives actually do happen exactly at a time of major economic crisis. So the New Deal is, I guess, the outstanding example of that. And we're facing a period where our country can't afford the healthcare system we have at present, and the pain is broadening far beyond the poor into the middle classes. And, you know, folks in this room are threatened along with people who are uninsured in poor communities around this country. That's the condition for political change. Now, our political leaders in Washington are likely to be the last people to find out about it. And I think that the situation in Washington, you know, political leadership has become the ultimate oxymoron. But the fact is that demand from outside Washington can actually move this country as well. And we had a charismatic president elected in 1960 who did not have very bold social programs that he proposed, and yet triggered a very broad outpouring of sentiment that succeeded in passing major social initiatives.
So David thinks this is going to happen. What do you think?
I think in a recession, people really get worried about health insurance, so the demand for their political leaders to do something about it grows whenever the economy tanks. The problem with states is that their ability to meet that demand also tanks because mm-hmm. sales tax revenues go down, unemployment compensation costs go up. And it's why we saw in Washington the need for federal fiscal relief to really pump prime. And I think we at least talked about, even though mostly what we did was to give people tax rebates, we at least talked about there are ways of stimulating the economy. And I would say by investing in the healthcare sector. Those are good jobs.
If I could just make one point, because you have said a couple of times the states can't go it alone. One of the reasons the states are in trouble is because the federal government is cutting SCHIP and other programs. They're capping the financing of these programs that the states rely upon to improve coverage. So it doesn't seem to be a state federal.
Right. You're absolutely right. It was the wrong response to the recession, and there were other ideas on the table, such as increasing the federal match for Medicaid and SCHIP. We ought to have a counter-cyclical matching rate built into those programs so that when the economy tanks, the federal government's picking up more of the costs and states are getting fiscal relief from it.
Can we also tackle this? Is this going to happen? I mean, absolutely. Okay.
Preaching hope, absolutely.
Do we have another question?
The recession is going to affect individuals the most, but employers and businesses are in an excellent position to fix it. They're the ones that we need to look at to determine how to help them, and it fits into healthcare costs because an employer burden right now is offering healthcare benefits. And this is scary and a little dramatic, but what if we took employers out of the healthcare benefit business and pooled the individuals instead? And did it that way, because then we could have the employers back to competing with the international folks who ask GM if they think this is a good idea. And then we have more money because suddenly we don't have tax credits for employers, right? So the federal government gets back all that money that they're giving to employers right now, and wages can go up. Oh, wages get recession, so. You see, there are some ways to figure this out. Yeah, sure, it can happen.
I'm an optimist. I think it's always dark before it gets really dark, but then it gets lighter. You asked about politics. I think in the short term, I wouldn't expect a lot other than kind of moving around for 2 years, short of planning any blood in the congressional elections, which kind of a 1965 situation. That's not quite there yet, but that it really doesn't matter who's elected president in terms of kind of we're going to get this comprehensive grant reform. I was on record in 1993 before other people were all saying all the time what's going to be the Clinton enacted reforms. I said it's not going to survive. It's not going to go through. Too complex. Too much. Sometimes we can make some progress, but politics is a lagging indicator. It will ratify what people have figured out it actually works, and then kind of will end up kind of adopting it in pieces. We're not going to kind of do great. We're not going to have any mandate after 2 years of thrashing around debate in Congress. We're going to get some marginal incentives that can kind of provide a little additional assistance to some folks to get some work there. We're going to learn a lot more about what actually works in healthcare and how to begin to insist upon more accountable delivery of care, and people will be able to insist upon that as well. We need to accelerate that process, but that's where the most promise lies. In a time of economic stress, there are less dollars to go around rather than more. We're going to rewrite a good bit of the tax code in the next 2 years, and healthcare is going to get less in tax subsidies than it did before. As a result of that, we may rationalize the approach to tax financing of care.
Okay, we have time maybe for one more question back there.
Brian Thompson with Kansas Public Radio. Kansas has a plan to reform not just healthcare, but health and wellness and, you know, a comprehensive type of reform. But they did an actuarial study of five different ways to address the problem of the uninsured. And all of those ways would raise the cost to the state by around $500 million, except for one, and that is a single-payer plan. That plan, according to the actuarial study, would cover everyone and cut the costs by about $800 million. And through the way it would be financed, it would put about $1 billion back into the pockets of the individual citizens. What they pay in taxes to fund this would be less than what they pay now for premiums that they would avoid. And so the question for politics to me is, you know, why do they say this is not feasible politically to cover everybody and save the citizens $1 billion? How is that not good politics?
Julie, well, it's good policy. It's terrible politics. My God. I mean, you're who are you not ticking off? You're eliminating the insurance industry. The physicians are going to be frightened. You don't frighten physicians. We need them. And consumers, if Kansas can convince the American people, we'll get behind it. But so far, we have seen over and over again, I mean, 1993-94, that was not the government takeover of healthcare, but you couldn't convince the American people of that. So it's not going to happen. We need to do what's politically palatable.
Karen, why don't
I just make one plea for reporters to really focus on the difference between total national health spending and federal budget spending. So single-payer plans may reduce total national health spending, but they have huge increases in government budget outlays. That's because employers, instead of paying premiums, are now going to be paying payroll taxes. Employers, including the Business Roundtable, have concluded they would rather stay in the business of covering the 160 million Americans who get their coverage through employer plans, where they have some control over what's covered. They can use their creativity to help try to control costs. They can get some credit from their workers as being a good employer that recruits and retains good workers because they have good benefits. There are ways of keeping a mixed public-private system with employers still in the business and achieving total health system savings. In fact, work we've supported shows you can save $1.5 trillion over 10 years, if you're willing to do a number of these things, primary care, patient-centered medical homes, comparative effectiveness, information technology, and cover everybody with a mixed public-private system.
And Tom, I'm going to let you say something, I'll let David have the last word, because it was a single-payer system, but did you want to respond to the that question?
Well, you know, we complain a lot about what employers do, about what insurers do, and about what doctors do. The only possible party to do a worse job in running our health care is the federal government, which has already demonstrated its performance abilities in many other areas recently. So you have to think about kind of who ultimately is going to be the decision maker in any system you support. Do you want to try to do that through the coalition of the ballot box? Do you want to be able to do it by commanding more of your resources and determining who your agents are who are answering to you in terms of accountability for the care you receive? That's fundamentally why single payer doesn't fly in the United States. It's not a bunch of stupid Americans who just won't vote for something that's good for them. In fact, they don't prefer that alternative when they have to deal with it close up and actually understand what it means in practice. If you can dictate prices and ensure that you're going to get the same value as before, that's a nice miracle, but it's not going to happen that way. That's why these cost projections show up that way, because it's all embedded in the assumptions, which aren't anchored in reality.
David, you get the last word.
Well, the projections that you cite are very similar to projections by the Congressional Budget Office and General Accountability Office that have found the same thing. Single payer actually saves money, provides upgraded coverage for virtually all Americans, but it's politically difficult, not because the American people don't want it, not because doctors don't want it, doctors want it, but because it antagonizes a few very wealthy people in this country. And the question is, can our country do something that two-thirds of Americans want, but that takes money out of the pockets of a few wealthy and powerful individuals? And that's really the question for our democracy. I'm an optimist. I think we still do live in a democracy. So I think actually it is something that we can achieve.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. As you can see, we're going to have a lot to write about in the next few years. So I appreciate you coming, and I think we've got another session on the way.
Yes, very, very good.
Yeah.